I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Lori R. from San Diego / Los Angeles.
Oh, boy. Thank you, thank you. Lori, I'm an alcoholic. Let's see. God, it's right in my face. Okay. All right. Perfect. Thank you. Hi, everybody. Okay, so it takes me a few minutes to get comfortable up here, so just letting you all know to bear with me. I'm new to San Diego, so I've been here for 6 months, and that's why I'd / Los Angeles, because that's where I've lived for the last 30 years. Prior to that was New York. New York. And it still hasn't left me. I'm still a New Yorker. My dad always told me, you were born a New Yorker, you'll die a New Yorker, no matter where you are. But my sobriety was in Los Angeles. So my sobriety date's October 10th, 1994. So I've got 23 years and some days and coming up on 24 years. And I'll tell you a little bit because nobody knows me here. So weird. I'll tell you, I'm in a kind of a funky, place because it's been 6 months, new job, new town, and new fellowship. And the rest of it was a no-brainer. The hardest thing was leaving my fellowship, the kind of place where you get a hug from somebody that knows you for over 23 years, that they can look at you and you say you're okay, and they go, no, tell me what's really going on. But our wonderful fellowship is our wonderful fellowship, whether it's New York, L.A., or here in San Diego, because I've shared that with some people. I need to go home because I need a hug, and I've had people tell me, come here, and grab me into a bear hug, where if I closed my eyes, I thought I was home. And that's the kind of things we do for each other around here. So welcome to all the people that are new. Welcome to our wonderful fellowship. And happy birthday to the birthday people, and thank you to Larry, Randy, and Brian, Liz Brian, for allowing me to come share my experience, strength, and hope. So I'll give you the 5-minute version, if I can, of what I was like, because I have a lot to say about recovery. But I was born and raised in New York, oldest of five. I was raised by two crazy, hot-headed Italians, and there was always yelling, screaming, drama, fighting in that house. My father used to drink and beat my mother up and sometimes beat us up. And somebody was always in the emergency room. Sometimes it was her. Sometimes it was one of us. And I can't tell you, I saw my father being taken away in handcuffs and my mother being taken away in an ambulance more than once. So I was terrified living in that house. So by the time I had my first drink, boy, I really needed it. And I had needed it for some time. I could have used a drink when I was like 8 because I was a stressed out kid. But the first drink did exactly what the book says. It gave me that sense of ease and comfort. Yeah, it took away the fear. It made living in that house okay. And it was like a flip switched for me. And the next 20 years from 13 to 33 was all about getting it, doing it, trying to figure out ways and means and get and do more of everything. It started with a drink and ended with a drink, and it worked every time. But it was the 70s, and I started drinking in the 70s, and that was the era of somebody say something? That was the era of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it was a great time to be young and on the planet. And the motto was not, it wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. thanks for sharing. And nobody ever asked, what is this? What's it going to do to me? What's it going to do for me? It was just, I got handed something, I said thanks, and I took it. I'm like, I must say, for you youngsters, you missed out on all the good shit, because the 70s, ask any one of us that were there for the 70s and the 80s before, just say no, it was a great time to be young and on the planet. I'll just say that. If you want more detail, I'll be happy to tell you. I started, I worked in nightclubs in New York, And I was a cocktail waitress, and the bars were open till 4 o'clock, and I went from bar to bar to bar to bar. And at 4:30, when you worked in the nightclub business, at 4:30, they locked the doors from the inside, and then the real party started. And it was a great time. I loved it. But at 25, I said, man, my name is mud in this town, because I was a little too well-known at every bar. And I had an opportunity to come here in the around 86 or 87 to come to Los Angeles. And, you know, I did what I now know is called the geographic, right? Because I thought if I could just get out of this town, these clubs and these people, I'll be okay and I'll start over. And I did the geographic, but I brought myself and my alcoholism with me. Me and my disease traveled 3,000 miles, and within 6 months, I found the clubs, I found the bars, I found the dealers, I found my people. And so I got sober in 94. So for the next 8 years, I wound up parking myself within 100 feet from my favorite bar. And there was the pot dealer, a Coke dealer, the bartender who knew my name. And when I walked through the door, there was my drink, cocktail napkin, my drink, and my seat. And I lived so close that I could look over the balcony and make my grand entrance as soon as I knew who was there. And you know what? That place, I always say if I could have moved my bed in there, I never would have left. That's how much I loved it. And so the last 4 years of my drinking and the first 4 years of my sobriety, I lived next to that bar. And, you know, the bartenders used to walk me home. Somebody used to take me home to get the key in the door, because even on my hands and knees, I couldn't get the key in the door to let myself home 100 feet from the front door. And, you know, I ended up in 1994... in a small room, never leaving my bedroom. I hadn't seen daylight for months. Shades drawn, a bottle of vodka under my arm. I couldn't even turn the TV on. No noise. I couldn't answer the phone. So my life got very small. It was just me and that bottle of vodka and a few other things. Because I knew I had a couple of dealers on speed dial that I knew in the neighborhood, and they delivered, and I didn't have to leave my house, and it got very small. So what happened, you think that was enough? No, wasn't enough for me to decide sobriety. I didn't really choose sobriety. It kind of happened to me. I wound up paying visits to emergency rooms. Started having seizures. And, I went, had one seizure in an emergency room. They hooked me up to machines and wires, and let's find out what's wrong with this young 33-year-old. Why is she having seizures? And they wouldn't let me smoke in there. And I pulled everything out, checked myself out, AMA, and went home and back to the alcohol. Because I couldn't stand to be away from it for even an hour. It was really, I was pathetic. Let's say that. It was not a vision for you. Next, a week later, another emergency room, and then a week after that, the third emergency room. This was 5 o'clock in the morning of October 10th, and I'm seizuring by myself. And I called my family doctor, my doctor who had taken care of me, and he said, meet me at the emergency room. And somehow I got myself there, and they took one look at me, and they called in a neurologist, 5 o'clock in the morning. He's on call to come look at this young woman. Why is this happening? Because I looked like, what's wrong? Why is this happening? He took one look at me when this guy showed up, and I got the look that I'm sure some of you have gotten, many of us get, well-meaning people, especially the medical community, but family, friends, and loved ones that try and help us, and they can't help us. And it was the look of disgust, like, you woke me up for this, because he took one look at me and knew, you know, that he probably wasn't going to be able to help me, asked me a list of, you know, what I had been taking, how much I had drank, and what kind of drugs was I doing. You know, and of course I tried to lie. but he gave me, here's what he told me. He said that when somebody comes in, has seizures that many times, what they're supposed to do is report you to DMV. They take away your driver's license. You can't get insurance, and you can no longer drive, and that makes your life a real hassle, right? And he said, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let you go, and I hope I never see you here under these circumstances again. And he gave me his card, business card, and said, come see me in 2 weeks, which I didn't do. But that was at 5 o'clock in the morning. At 8 o'clock that night, I went to my first meeting. That business card sat on my dining room table for a whole year. And when I turned a year sober, I sent him my first one of my one-year chips with a letter and thanked him. You know, because if he had the slightest bit of kindness and compassion, you'd have a different speaker. It was that look and the way he treated me and the things he said and the way he talked. I heard it, and I wound up going to a meeting. So, meetings. I started going to meetings. I went from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting. And at that time, there was 3,000 meetings a week in Los Angeles. Now there's about 4,000 a week. But that's what y'all told me to do, so that's what I did. I went from meeting to meeting to meeting. Sat in a lot of meetings. And what happened for me is that I got sicker and sicker and worse and worse and more angry and more restless, irritable, and discontent, more uncomfortable in my own skin sitting in meetings. I was suffering from this thing called untreated alcoholism, but I didn't know it. I'm sure you all were talking about the steps. I'm sure they were talking about the steps and God and sponsorship and the big book in meetings, but I wasn't hearing any of it. So for that first 2 months, all I did was sit in meetings in the back of the room, thinking to myself, I'm sitting in a metal chair drinking coffee out of a styrofoam cup with a bunch of strangers. You know, boy, my life is fucked up. Yeah. And my best thinking is what got me here. And I thought, no way on earth are these people going to be able to do a damn thing for me. So at 60 days, I started planning my escape while I was sitting in meetings. I was plotting and planning, and my great idea was... I'm going to call this dealer that I know, who I had his number on by memory. Call him, buy an 8-ball, get in the car, drive to Vegas, sit at the first table I could find, and drink as many free drinks as they'll give me. And that's as far as I got with the plan. And I started feeling better just thinking about it. Yeah. And the meeting, on a break, it was a smoke break, and I went out on the ledge, and I was ready to make a beeline for the door, but I stopped and had a cigarette, and this little woman came up and said, "How you doing?" I'm like, "You really don't want to hear it, do you?" And I told, you know, and for the first time, I actually told the truth, because I thought she really was interested in how I was feeling. I told her how I was feeling about this program, all of you, and I told her my plan. And she kind of laughed and thought, nodded her head and said, "No, that might work. That might make you feel better. But, you know, we have something here that works even works even better. Have you tried our program?" And I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about? I've been coming to meetings for the last 60 days. What are you talking about?" And she said, "Come to my house tomorrow night. Bring your big book, and 8 o'clock, be at my house, bring your book, and I'll help you." So I said, "Okay, I can give Alcoholics Anonymous one more day. If it doesn't work, I can go to Vegas tomorrow night." And I showed up the next day at her house, 8 o'clock, with my book, and the shades are drawn, the lights are off, there's no car in the driveway, nobody there. So I immediately got angry. What the fuck are these people doing? What are they talking about? What's going on with? And then I thought maybe something happened to her, because she really did mean it when I talked to her yesterday. So I got in the car and drove to the nearest phone booth, because yes, for you youngsters back then, this is BC before cell phones. We actually had to go find and so I drove to this Vaughn Shopping Center, and there was a there was a phone on the wall. You know, it wasn't actually a phone booth. I call it a phone booth, but there was a phone on the wall, payphone, and we had to call these ancient things called, I called my answering machine at home, and there was a message from her. There was a message from somebody else who I can't remember. Her message said, I've been detained at work. Keep yourself busy until 8:30, until I can get there, and I'll see you at 8:30. And a message from somebody else, and then the third message was from my Coke dealer. He was calling to check in on me. He hadn't talked to me in a few months. You know? and knew exactly how long it had been. 62 days was the last time I talked to him. So I did them. I had a half an hour to kill, so I did the most logical thing. I called the dealer back. I didn't want to be rude, right? I needed to return his phone call, check in, let him know I'm okay. And I stood there at this phone booth and made the phone call. And as I was talking to him, I went right back into the alcoholic, hip, slick, and cool hack that I used to wear to everybody, but especially to people like him. And I slipped right back into that. And I was laughing with him, trying to act cool, and holding back the tears, and laughing, and wanting to cry, because I knew it was a surrender. This thing called alcoholism, I'm not big enough, I'm not strong enough to fight it. It's way bigger and way more powerful than me, and it was a surrender. Like, I don't know what else to do, but I know that I will immediately get some ease and comfort if I give up the fight. So that's where I was in that moment, and I hung up the phone with him and started burst into tears and started running toward my car. And while I was on the phone, a line had formed of people waiting to use this phone. And in the corner of my eye, I happened to catch this, very good-looking guy who was totally my type. He had, long hair and tight Levi's and cowboy boots. And I remember to this day exactly what he looked like. And I happened to catch him in the corner of my eye. I hung up the phone and went running toward my car. And all of a sudden, somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's him. And he said, "Hey, why are you crying?" And he was listening to the phone call, so he knew exactly who I was and what I was doing because he heard it. And he said, "Hey, why are you crying?" I said, "Oh, it's a long story. You don't want to hear it." And he said, "Sure I do. Give me the short version." And I said, "Do you know anything about alcohol and drugs?" And he said, "As a matter of fact, I do. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for 8.5 years. And I said, "Oh, you are? Okay." We stood in that parking lot for like it was probably 5 minutes. It felt like an hour went by. And, "Oh, what meetings are you going to?" I showed him my chip. I had, we call them chips in L.A., I had a 60-day chip, and I'm sober, 62 days. I'm going to meet this sponsor. I've got my book in the car, and he asked me what meetings I was going to, and, "Oh, make sure you go to this meeting. You live in Culver City. Make sure you go to that meeting. I know the secretary there, and go there," and said, "You're going to be okay." Kissed me on the cheek and sent me on my way. And, that's kind of how God works. He uses whoever's available. That night, it happened to be this man named Flo, and he is he's 33 years sober. He was there at the grocery store buying diapers for his baby. He was waiting for the phone to call his wife to find out what kind of diapers to buy, and that's how our paths crossed. And that little baby is 25 years old, just graduated from college, and he's still here, and I'm still here. And, sometimes they're here for a minute, for one moment. Sometimes it's for a season, and sometimes it's for a lifetime. And Flo is one of those lifetime friends. And it turns out, I didn't know, he was this big guy in AA. He sponsors everybody. He's all over the place. And I'm so grateful he's in my life. And he's still the most beautiful man I know. So I went from suicidal that morning, and I get to my sponsor's house, and now I'm skipping through the door. And said, "You'll never guess what just happened to me." And she said, "Was it a God shot?" And I said, "I don't know nothing about no God shot, but let me tell you what just happened." This is not the kind of language I used, God shot. So I told her the story about meeting Flo. And she said to me at about 7:45 when I realized I was going to be late, I stopped and prayed. I asked God to take care of you until I could get there. And I knew that he'd do something. I just didn't know what. And my mouth dropped. I just said, who is this God? And how do I get one? I want that in my life. And that's the night I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and that big book. And we got to work right away, opened up the book, and a word at a time, a line at a time, a page at a time. And I went back to our house the next night and said, I'm coming back here tomorrow. And I was feverishly, you know, looking for, I want that kind of power in my life. And this, my sponsor, she's been my sponsor, I just talked to her this morning, since I'm 60 days sober, and she had this, she was 4'11", but when she opened her mouth, it was like King Kong stepped into the room, because that woman was powerful. Because she was backed with this, she had this amazing higher power. And I wanted it, you know, and I didn't think I could have that. And, you know, and she told me, okay, when you leave here tonight, put God in the passenger seat, the car, and take him home with you. When you get home, pull up a chair, put God in the chair and talk to him. When you leave tomorrow, take God with you. Put him in the passenger seat and take him to work. And so, you know, that's kind of how my little path, my path started. It was me and God. You know, and especially needed God to walk into a room like this, because you people still terrified me at that time. So I would sit in the car and go, God, you got to go into the room first, make sure I'm safe, and then I'll follow you. And amazingly, I would come into the meeting and I was safe. You know, and so it, and for the longest time, I prayed to Rachel's God, because I wasn't quite sure mine was going to be big enough, but she had this big, amazing God. So by the end of the week, I made that third step decision and started getting into a fourth step. And at the end of, you know, it took me about 6 months to go through all the steps. And I want to talk about my experience with the steps in that first year, especially after I did, right after I did my fifth step. I had just finished doing my fifth step with my sponsor, and I get this, I'll back up a little bit. My mother, the one I told you about, that my father used to beat up, and he used to beat us up, and that horrible childhood that I thought I had, because this is a story I told myself through my alcoholic haze, what happened in my childhood wasn't the whole truth. And my 34th birthday, I get this photo album in the mail from my mother. This is your life, my baby bracelet and baby pictures and cheerleading and gymnastics and everything about my life. And she was right there with me through all of it. Kindergarten, there was a picture of her, me holding my little kindergarten graduation and her looking down at me and me looking up and up at her and our eyes are locked. And I said, what the hell happened? You know, what happened? So I cried for days because, I forgot to tell you about the inventory portion. I hadn't talked to my mother in 10 years, so I hated her. You know, I think that's kind of a prerequisite for us. We got to hate one or both of our parents. So I hated her, and I didn't talk to her for 10 years, and I went out of my way to hurt her. You know, I mean, what she did to me, okay. But what I did to her was far worse, and I found that out in the fifth step and doing the fourth step in the fourth, you know, in that fourth column, putting out of our minds the wrongs that others had done. What did we do? What were, you know, where was I at fault? What did I do to cause or contribute to the situation? And I had to look at my behavior, not hers. And it was eye-opening to me that what I did to her was far worse than anything she ever did to me, because I intentionally went out of my way to try and hurt her. For 10 years. How do you make amends for that? So, you know, I finished the fifth step. This photo album came. I looked through it for days, crying, discussed it with my sponsor. At that time, I was doing my eighth step list and needing to start making amends. And I said to her, how the hell do I make amends for this? How do you fix that? And I don't do anything without HP, you know, without the higher power. And I had to give this one to him, you know. In fact, any amends I tried to make was a disaster with me trying to do it on my own power. So I gave the whole list to God, and I prayed about it. And one morning I just woke up, and it just came to me. you know, the words came to me. I wrote a long letter to my mother, and I thanked her for everything she ever did for me. I acknowledged all the things about me that I inherited from her, and all the things about me that were just like her, and gave her something I'd withheld for 10 years, acknowledgement, love, appreciation, all in a letter. Read it to my sponsor, said, is this okay to send? She said, mail it. Put a stamp on it, mailed it. My mom was in New York, and, you know, and that's, it's 23 years ago. And today, I got my mother back in my life because of this. And I could have missed that had it not been for the steps and taking direction and doing something that I had no idea whether or not it would work. But I did the next action. And you know, and I look back and think, man, I could be making a graveside amends. I could have missed that. And I got my mom back in my life. Same thing with my dad. Again, you know, that my dad, one time in New York, I would say he died when I was 10 years sober. But when I was about 11 years prior to that, we were in the car in New York on Long Island driving. I was stuck in the car with him from the tip of Long Island all the way to Kennedy Airport, and with him yelling at me all the way, how ashamed he was at my behavior. And all I could do was look down at my feet. I couldn't even look him in the eye, crying the whole time. And he said, what the hell happened? What the hell happened to my daughter out in Los Angeles? What is going on? And put me on a plane. And then years later, he'd never been to a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous. But he knew what I was like, that something tremendous had happened to me because I was coming to these meetings, and what I'm like now. And so I would talk to him in New York on the phone, and he'd say, you still going to those meetings? I go, yeah, Dad, still going to those meetings. Good, keep going to those meetings. And he had never been to a meeting before. But to go from that trip to the airport to, you know, before he died, he said he was proud it was his daughter. And I went from there to here. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I could not have done that on my own. When he was sick and dying, you know, I went to my sponsor again and said, "Dad's dying. What do I do?" And she gave me the best direction that anyone could have given me. She said, "You suit up and show up and be of service to your dad. Suit up and show up. Be of service to your mom. Be of service to your family members. Go there. Don't dump your pain on those people. It's not about you. This is about him." And then go to meetings and share what's going on and ask for help there. So I, one more time, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous showed up for me. I went to meetings in New York, room full of strangers, raised my hand. My dad's dying. I'm in pain. Help me. And that fellowship showed up for me. In fact, when he died, I was at the funeral, you know, the funeral home, these people from Alcoholics Anonymous, all dressed in suits, showed up and sat there with me. And I said, what are you all doing here? I didn't even know they knew my last name, how they could even find me. They said, we know how hard these things could be, and we thought you could use a friend. That's the kind of things that we do for each other around here. Nowhere else on earth, if I had asked for it, could I find that kind of the kind of unconditional love and support that we give to each other. So I'm forever grateful that the fellowship has just carried me. So that's a little bit, there's a lot more stories with amends, but those are the big ones. And I will say, you know, I've done a lot of service over the years, from starting with coffee. Anybody make coffee here? Freya? Thank you for your service. I think that I know the newcomer is supposed to be the most important person in the room, but I have a difference of opinion about that. I think the coffee person is the most important person in the room. And that coffee pot saved my life. I give that coffee pot credit for saving my life. My first week of sobriety, I went to this little AA meeting close to my job. And I showed up there. All I could do was get through the day just to get to the meeting. All I wanted was a cup of coffee. And there was no coffee at the meeting. I went back the second week. I thought I'd give him one more chance. And again, no coffee. And they asked for burning desires at the end of the meeting. And I, you know, this kind of newcomer I was. My hand went up. Hey, what the hell kind of AA meeting is this? Where the hell's the coffee? What the fuck? And the meeting ended, and they surrounded me and handed me this big giant box with the coffee pot and all the coffee supplies and said, you're going to be our coffee person. And nobody asked me, would you like to do coffee? Nobody asked me, would you like a commitment here? They said, you're making the coffee. And I was the first person there, the last one to leave. Everybody knew my name. I knew I was the most important person there because y'all would be really, you'd really miss me if I wasn't there. And at the end of the year, I celebrated a year of sobriety making that coffee. So for anybody that's new, especially for the newcomers, don't pick and choose what you will and won't do around here. Do whatever you're asked to do. There's a method to our madness. I didn't know. I thought I was being service to them. But you know what? That meeting would, and everybody in it would have survived just fine without me and without that coffee pot. But I probably wouldn't be standing here if it wasn't for that meeting and that coffee pot. So, you know, we do kind of know what we're doing. So don't question, you know, even if you think my head always used to say, no, I don't want to do that. And I'd say, yes, sure, I'll do that. And it served me well, and that's why, they tell us don't turn down an AA request, whatever you're asked to do. So how am I doing on time? Okay, about 10 minutes? Perfect. So I was about, so after doing all this service work, I went through the 12 steps, studied the big book, was able to incorporate it in my life, and then wound up being a service to other people and taking other people through the steps. I found out that I'm not as dumb as I thought I was. I always wanted to, one of the things I missed, because I missed college because I majored in drugs and alcohol, and I was busy in clubs and running the streets, and so I never had the opportunity to go. And it was one thing I always wanted. I always wanted to go to college and didn't think I was this is what I used to tell myself. You're not good enough. You're not smart enough. It's too hard. It's too expensive. You don't deserve it. And you're not worth it. Now, nobody ever told me that, but those are the things I used to tell myself about college. And I don't know, I was about 10 years sober, and I went to my sponsor and said, after doing all of that, I think maybe I could go to college. And I told my sponsor, hey, I think I want to go to college. She said, great. Show up, you know, and fill out the application and go. And I started at a community college, Santa Monica College, and I how I did college is by suiting up and showing up, one class at a time, one chapter at a time, one assignment at a time, asking for help, doing the work, sitting in the front, getting there early, staying till the class is over, and just a day at a time, and then the next indicated thing. And I went from that community college to a university and got a bachelor's degree. And from there, I went on to another university. And in 2013, I walked across the stage with a master's degree. Thank you. That's good. That's the higher power. Man, I'm telling you, I have to take him with me to meetings. I had to take him with me to every class. And say, especially before, I would pray on exams and pray writing a paper. God, I need your help. Bring to mind everything I know so I can pass this test. I'm quite sure that it was me and God. I was not doing that alone. That was in 2013, and then about 2 years ago, I got to go back to that little community college that I love so much. This time, on the other side of the table, I got to go back as a professor and teach a class there. How do you do that? Jeez, they're like a room full of newcomers, and I'm sponsoring every one of them. I'm a little further down the path than they are. I've been through the work before that they're, and I was sitting in those same seats where they are. And that's how I approach teaching, and it's so what a gift to be able to be of service. You know, because that is, it's not about, you know, you don't get rich teaching. You know, you get to be of service and help others. And I always say, man, God gave us, all of us, our own special gifts and talents. And they were meant to be used, you know, my these special gifts and talents that I was given, that, and all the things that I have done, they're not meant to be used for selfish reasons. They're meant to be used to help others. Okay, awesome. 10 more minutes. So, you know, so whatever it is, because I say, man, I don't even know what the hell I was going to do with the master's degree. You know, the point is, I wanted to go to college, and you all told me I could. And I wanted to get a master's degree, and you all told me I could. Just suit up and show up. And basically, anything you want to have around here, you can have as long as we're willing to suit up and show up and do the work. Right? And so I wasn't sure, you know, what the hell. It did help a little bit with this transfer that I got to San Diego. And I'll tell you what my life is like now. I'm here in San Diego. I'm a newcomer to the fellowship, but I absolutely love it. You know, like I said, I've got stories. I'm going to tell you one LA story from my home group about the fellowship, so you'll see why I love this fellowship so much. But okay, but I'll talk about what I'm doing now. Is you know, this higher power? I wanted to retire in San Diego. That was my plan. Well, I'm not exactly retired yet, but God saw fit and gave me a path to get here a little bit sooner than I had planned, and I'm not quite sure. So this is to be continued. What I'm supposed to be doing here, you know? But it was the job transfer and it was the opportunity to get me here in San Diego, where I wanted to be, and so, you know, I'm waiting for God to show me, okay, what's next, you know, what am I supposed to be doing here. But I want to tell you a fellowship story. This is one of my favorites. When I was about 10 years sober, I used to go to this Saturday night meeting, big Saturday night meeting, just like this one. I was a regular there, and there was a guy named Marlon, a guy in my of my fellowship, who he had 11 years. And every Saturday night, it seemed like Marlon sponsored half the room, and it seemed like every Saturday night everybody was talking about what a great time they had at Marlon's barbecue last Sunday. And are you going to Marlon's house tomorrow? Because it seemed like he was having a barbecue every weekend. And I never went because I wasn't invited. Marlon didn't ask me, didn't invite me. Memorial Day weekend that year, my friend Dave had been out drinking and had come back after 10 years of sobriety. He had 4 days sober, and he got invited to Marlon's house for the barbecue. And he asked me to go with him because he was afraid to go and face all the guys by himself. And I said, I'm not going. I wasn't invited. And he said, I'm inviting you. You come with me. And we sat outside of Marlon's house for like an hour trying to talk each other into getting out of the car, both for different reasons. He was afraid to face all the guys, and I just knew everybody in the backyard was going to know I wasn't invited, right? So we finally got out and walked into Marlon's backyard, and the guys just surrounded Dave and pulled him in, nothing but love, and just did what we do around here, man. Love, we just love and tolerance of others is our code, and love first. And then me, I'm standing there, Marlon comes running over, Larry, you're here. I said, yeah, even though I wasn't invited, but Dave invited me. And he just looked at me and said, Lori, you're always invited. You're a member of our sober crew. I don't ever have to invite you. You're always invited. Well, I could have kissed him. You know, that was Memorial Day. Then 4th of July is coming up. We were at a big meeting like this, and Marlon he was sitting over there one night, and I'm sitting all the way over there. And the meeting ended, the speaker, you know, people thanking the speaker, picking up chairs, and he made his way all the way through the crowd and came over and said, Lori, I'm having a barbecue at my house on the 4th of July. I just want to make sure you know about it, and you know that you're invited. And I could have kissed him again. That's the kind of things we do for each other. You know, the love and tolerance of what members of this fellowship have done for me over and over again. This fellowship always shows up for me. And I'm really grateful to be in San Diego, and that was the only reason I knew I could come here. I knew I could move without any problems because all of you were here. All right, young man, how much time do I have? 5 minutes? Okay, what else? I'm pretty much that's all of it. I want to say to the newcomers, you're part of our sober crew, and you're always invited. And don't forget that. And please reach out, because we cannot we can't help you if we don't know you're hurting. You know, and you got to let someone know. Because we can't always tell. Sometimes I show up and nobody knows what's really going on with me. It's on me to reach out and share and let people know, hey, I need your help. And when I do, the fellowship's always there for me. And for the newcomers too, we are all here to help. And I mean that. And when we say, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself, have you heard that? Do you guys say that down here in San Diego? Yeah. Yeah, and even more important, the fellowship is here that loves me when I can't love myself, when I feel like I absolutely can't love myself. You all just love me back to health. So I hope I said something that that helped someone, you know, because this was, I had nothing planned, and you know, God did the talking. So please reach out and let somebody help you. And I think that's it. I'm going to wrap up. Thank you. Oh! All right. How much more time? I want to read one thing from the book. I just want to read one paragraph, then I'll be done. I want to read my favorite paragraph. Sorry. One paragraph. Page 100. Okay. One paragraph. And then I'm going to wrap it up. Okay, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were much better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Okay, now I'm done. Thank you.